Succession number 27309, Reel 2.
Yes, the first flight was Air Experience for an hour and a half, and the second flight, of course, dual. Climbs, glides, turns, 90-degree approaches, glide landings, takeoffs, taxiing, left-hand spins. Yeah, turns, and approaches, and emergencies, landings, takeoffs, and then a solo check, which I passed, first solo.
How was the stamina to fly? Was it? Did it have any vices or anything that would?
Well, the only vice it had really it was kind of what I remember of it, never having flown anything else. Of course, difficult to say whether it was easy or difficult, because you had nothing to compare it with. But what it did have a nasty habit was it was ground looping. I.e., when you landed on the ground, it would turn very sharply, the wing would dip and touch the ground, and of course that would damage the plane and everything, and it's absolutely impossible to stop it once it started into a ground loop. So you had to make sure you kept it straight on landing, straight ahead, you know, don't let it veer, because you get into a ground loop and then you really mucked it up.
One of the things obviously with people who've never flown is that spinning always looks quite terrifying. What instruction would you give on how to control the aircraft if it got into a spin? What do you do?
What you do if it gets into a spin? Well, you try and level it out and push the stick far forward as you can, or, you know, right forward, pick up a bit of airspeed, because it spins because it's lost airspeed, and it's falling out of the sky. there was one here, you see, inverted spin, and that was about a month after I'd first flown.
So, yeah. Well, what's an inverted spin?
Well, when it spins upside down. It's even worse than spinning the right way up.
Do you
of course, all these biplanes like that were built to do these things. Now, when you get onto a Corsair, if you look at the pilot's handbook, which is rather like a motor car handbook, you know, pilot's notes, almost every page it says, do not spin this aircraft. Almost every page, not quite, but big black letters. Because the forces that it would were involved to get it out of the spin were far higher than you could exert pressure on the stick to make it, to correct it. So if you get in a spin in a Corsair, you're finished. But these little planes were built to spin, of course. Like a tiger moth, you know.
So you went solo after about 12 hours, which you said was average. How did you feel having soloed?
Terrified, probably. I think one felt, cool, oh, I've done it. You know, what an achievement. I'm actually, look at me, I'm here. Just because you'd never done it before.
You also mentioned as well that obviously the instructors were quite hard on some of the...
They were, yes, they were.
What happened when they were failed at this stage? Would they then be sent somewhere else?
They were sent back to Blighty, sent back to England. But they had... The expression was, if you failed an exam, i.e. a check, you dipped. You dipped. And if you dipped twice, for instance, there, I dipped that one, but I passed the next two and the next day. So I passed, but actually I dipped on that one. The instructor didn't think I was good enough. So he said, no, I won't pass you. So then you do it again.
And if it happened twice, you were off the course.
Yeah. There's no point going on trying to train somebody who's not picking it up.
You said, though, that obviously with these American instructors, that them being hard, did you have the same instructor?
Well, yes, to start with. Yes, I did. A fellow called, well, I won't say his name, he may still be alive, but he was a dreadful chap. And then when you got these exams, these checkouts, as it were, you'd be written on the board that you're going off at 12 o'clock with the instructor. So And people who say, oh, he's fine, he's all right. And some go, oh, if you've got him, you've no chance. Well, I suppose that's normal in life, isn't it?
Yeah. Obviously there, because was there any difference, obviously, when you were being trained as well between the kind of American discipline and your own discipline within the Fleet Air Arm?
Well, yes, there was a bit. But of course, we were attached to them. Although we had a senior British Naval officer in New York, actually, and we had a British Naval officer on the Gros Eagle and the other station, they were really just if something desperately went wrong or something, they were there. But they had nothing whatever to do with our day-to-day training and whatever else. We were entirely run by the Americans, which, they did things a bit differently, but generally speaking, it worked. Must have done.
Because I believe there was sort of different levels of discipline, in a sense, things that may have been let go with the Fleet Arm the Americans were quite tight on, and vice versa.
Yes, I think they tended to be a bit niggly on detail, tiny details, and they'd sort of bawl you out for doing something which you thought was absolutely, wasn't all that important, as it were. But, yes, I think we joined in.
So was the next move from Gros Eagle to Pensacola?
Yes, we went from Gros Eagle to Pensacola.
Was that for the advance? Would that be for advanced training?
Ah, yes. Now, we went to Pensacola in October. July we went to Brazil, and October we went to Pensacola. And there, of course, we flew monoplanes. We gave up the old biplane Stearman. And the first one we flew was a thing called a Valti Valiant, which was a fixed undercard, two-seater, one behind the other. But it was a monoplane, and it was much more of an aeroplane than the Stearman. And we flew that, and then we flew SNJ, the Harvard American designation was an SNJ, and that was an advanced trainer, because that had, well, has, you know, they're still around. That has a 600 horsepower engine, and it was a retractable undercart, which the Valiant didn't have, and it had a variable speed propeller, constant speed, or can't remember. I think it wasn't like a Corsair. It was variable speed. You could any revs you wanted to put on, you could. I think it had two speed. Propeller. I mean, you can check that out now and go down to shore and have a look at one. They've got them down there.
With a two-speed propeller, why are there two speeds on a propeller? What would you use it for?
Well, you take off with the maximum revs, which would mean a fine picture of the propeller. When you wanted to go around like a car, you go for a sort of touring about, then you put it in high pitch and it saves fuel and but it's not so responsive, rather like a high gear in a car, you know, top gear isn't so responsive and
And are there any differences between flying biplanes and obviously flying monoplanes?
Basically no, I suppose. Not really, I suppose.
With the Valiant and the Harvard, how unforgiving were they as aircraft? Did they have any vices, or was there anything that you had to be careful of when flying them?
No, I don't think so. The Harvard was a very nice aeroplane. We flew those for an awful long time. Lots of hours on Harvards. Because they were so, they could do anything you wanted them to do in the way of training, you know. As I said, they had a fairly powerful engine. and they had machine guns flying, firing through the propeller, which was quite clever. Actually, I think that was invented in the First World War, a synchronized gun firing through the propeller. Whereas the Valiant, of course, didn't have any armament. No, I think it was a very nice plane.
Obviously, there was a difference between what you'd learnt in your basic training at Gros Hill and what you learnt at Pensacola. What were the types of things you were learning in advanced training?
One thing, of course, the Harvard had, I don't think the Valiant, the Vultee thing had, is a radio. So you had to learn to use a radio. That may seem a bit simple, but it doesn't.
Can you explain why it is,
instead of waiting for a green light from the tower, either a very pistol with a flare, a green flare, or a green oldest lamp flashing at you to tell you to go, or a red one to tell you not to land or not to take off, you called up the tower on the radio and you had to get the sort of radio language sorted out. You couldn't just say, hello, this is Joe, you know, what about Anton? You'd have to be, particularly an American, you know, you had to say the right words in the right order. That was one thing about the American training. Everything had to be done according to the instructions. And we found in later flying that the British pilots were trained in Britain and perhaps Canada. It was much more to the point. Point of sale, I think we use that word now. The Americans, if you had a problem or wanted to communicate about anything, it had to be done in a certain way. You had to use the certain phrases in a certain, you know. Whereas it was much more fluent in English training, much more easygoing, perhaps. And they got the same answer, the same result, probably better. Americans were very, you know, regimented in that way. Anyway, what else did we do in Harvard? Oh, we did shooting, of course, air gunnery.
What did that actually entail with the air gunnery? What targets were you using?
Well, a drogue towed behind an aircraft on a long string. don't shoot down the tug plane. Some of these things I've got written in my book here, I can't even remember what it was all about.
Were you doing any formation flying?
This was another thing. We did a bit with the Stearmans, but that was just the very last sort of hour or two's flying at Gros Hill was formation flying. But of course, the Vultee picked it up a bit, and then the Harvards, you had to really, because you can't fly anywhere by yourself. At least not a very good idea in combat anyway. So formation flying was an extremely important part of getting to fly, you know.
What type of formations would you be flying within during training?
Well, a leader and two wingmen, or three wingmen, two on one side and one on the other, was the basic formation. I'm not sure whether it was quite a good idea, but looking back years later, you know, perhaps a different formation would have worked better. But anyway, that's what we were doing then.
Is it easy to fly in formation, or is there anything that you have to be aware of while you're doing it?
Oh, yeah. Well, it really, a lot depends on the leader. As long as he doesn't do anything abrupt and without notice. In the Stearman, of course, you didn't have a radio, so he used hand signals to say that he was going to turn or he was going to go down or up or whatever. But when the Harvards, we had a radio, he'd call you up and say, you know, starboard 90 or something. That's all he had to say. And you knew he was going to do a sharp turn starboard, port, whichever. Yeah, so Other than that, I don't think the formation flying was very difficult.
Did you do any aerobatics? I'm thinking of the sort of very, you know, the kind of basic barrel rolls, that type of thing, at that stage.
Hang on, let's see, 1944. Aerobatics. There you are. Practice aerobatics, practice aerobatics, practice aerobatics, aerobatics, check. Formation. Columns, formation. You have to be careful in formation, but as I say, somebody doesn't suddenly do something without any of the other people knowing what he was going to do. Yeah. Division tactics, you see.
What was that?
Well, six plane column, six aircraft instead of three, or four. And then two plane sections, that's two wings of three, or four. Yes, it was pretty... And all this, of course, was every day. January the 16th, 17th, 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 18, 18, 18, 18, 19, 19, 23, 23, 31, 31. So you flew at least once a day, probably twice.
So it was very intensive, obviously,
very intensive,
in that period.
Very intensive.
Could you still be failed at this stage of the course?
Oh, yes, certainly. Certainly. I don't think many were. I think they've mostly been... weeded out by then, by this time, but I expect there were people who were dipped, as we used to say.
And how confident were you feeling at that stage of your abilities as a pilot? Were you happy at that stage?
Oh yeah. And then this section here is dive bombing, you see. A whole lot about dive bombing.
What was that? What did that entail then? Because obviously that's another side, isn't it? Really, to the training.
Well, we used to be fitted out with flour bombs, you know, stuff you make bread out of. and then there was a target on the ground, and of course approaching the target was part of the instruction. You, bearing in mind that you're attacking an enemy position of some sort, you can't just tiddle about and fly down and you know, sort of an afternoon jolly. That's really what it would boil down to, getting in to, correctly, and then getting out also. But we used these flower bombs, which sounds a bit silly, but it was very effective because you could see where it landed and it didn't do anybody any harm.
When you were doing a dive bombing attack on a target, which is the point where you release? Where would you release the flower bomb? When you, where's the location of the target?
Oh, I can't remember what release height was in, because it's in a fighter. It's not in a bomber. I forget now. I suppose you had to release it 100 feet or something.
Would the target be in front of you at that point, though, or would it? Would you be directly above it?
Oh no. You can't dive straight down. That's not on. You could never get it straight up, except if you were, you know, the tail had been shot off or something, and then it went straight down and then went straight into the deck or the sea. No, the angle of dive was about 45 degrees usually, and then according to the wind and the drift and this and that, you know, you had to all be thought out before you started, you know. And
would you calculate that prior to the practice, or would you?
Probably, you probably were told by the Met people that the weather would be fine or whatever, and the wind would be southwest and force 3 or something. So you then had an idea. You'd then look at things like, well, over the sea, the waves, which way they were breaking on the sea surface, but on land you'd pick up things like flags or trees or smoke or something. You could see which way, knowing that. Basically, it was going to come from, what, let's say, southwest. And then so you more or less could pick it up from there. But then that's practice, isn't it? If the smoke's going out at a tremendous pace from the chimney, well, it's got a fairly high wind behind it, so you adjust things accordingly. But that is training. Yeah. Yes, so we did that for... I flew hundreds of hours in... Well, that's another thing that the Americans were very good at. If you're going to fly a Corsair, which we were all aiming to either fly a Corsair or a Hellcat, or a Wildcat, which preceded the Hellcat, you work up... to fly, let's say, a Corsair in my case, and nothing else. You were never aiming to, or they never were trying to get you to be a pilot to pick up this airplane, there's another Hellcat over, they're going to take that somewhere, or whatever. You were trained to fly that particular aircraft, and by jolly, they were good at it. You knew what you were doing. 400 and something hours training, eventually. Completed flight training, May 30th, 1944. Ability as a student pilot above average. Passed Category A. Signed by Donald Gibson, Lieutenant Commander RN, Senior British Naval Officer, Jacksonville.
So, had you gone to Jacksonville to learn purely about the Corsair?
Yes. Yes. That's the first time we flew a Corsair. And get out of a Harvard, a 600 horsepower Harvard, into a 2,200 horsepower Corsair with nothing between the two. That was quite frightening. And it's a single seater, of course. So Harvard, at least you could have an instructor. Yeah.
Can you give me a description, really, of the Corsair, what it looked like and how it handled and if there was any... vices?
Well, I used to think it was a wonderful, of course I would, wouldn't I? A wonderful aircraft. First of all, it was very rugged, extremely rugged. You could do particularly a sort of landing, particularly landing on an aircraft carrier. Things didn't always go quite right. The ship was going up and down 60-odd feet at the time, and you were coming in, possibly not quite right, and you hit the deck, as they say. And it didn't bother the aeroplane terribly, unless perhaps it would burst a tire or something. But it could put up with it, you know. Whereas you get a sea fire, and if you landed that heavily, it broke it up. It really did. So, of course, it was rugged, typical American. It was overbuilt. But it was superb for that reason. It did have a nasty habit of... At low speed, and I mean landing type of speed, the engine was so powerful and a huge propeller on the front, and if you opened the throttle very quick, it would turn the aeroplane over. The torque was so tremendous that instead of the aeroplane staying on the even keel and the propeller picking it up speed-wise, it would flip the aeroplane on its all over. And then if you were very low landing or something, particularly on a deck, that could be fatal. So you had to be very well aware that at that really slow speed, pour on the coals, as we used to say, not too... firmly, but obviously don't just push it forward with a bang, because it'll turn the aircraft over. But other than that, I think it wasn't an easy airplane to fly until you got used to it.
What were the problems with it?
Well, the problem was that the pilot sat on the equivalent of the trailing edge of the wing. If you look at a Corsair now, you can see what I mean. So when you had it in level flight, you had 17 foot of nose in front of you. And of course, it being a radial, the nose was, the bit in front of you was parallel. It didn't taper off like a Spitfire, for instance, to a propeller at the end, which you had a certain amount of visibility either side of the engine. This was dead straight. 17 feet of it. So when you came to land on a carrier, When you straightened out in the final turn and you're on the downwind leg to turned into crosswind and final turn into the landing, and pulled it up to, because it was a three-point landing plane with a hook on the back. You had to lift it up to catch the hook. You could see absolutely nothing. You couldn't even see the ship, let alone the batsman, the deck control officer with his bats, telling him what to do. You couldn't see him at all. Everything was blotted out by this enormous... So once you were committed to the deck, that was it. You were committed to the deck. which didn't always help.
Was visibility a problem taking off with it as well?
Well, again, if you opened the throttle hard taking off, it would pull the aircraft, even if it was on the ground, it would still pull the aircraft rather like a binding brake in a car. I put the brake on and the brakes are pulling. It did the same with the airplane, with the engine.
Because I was thinking as well, even with something like taxiing, I've seen photographs of airmen sat on the wings to direct Corsairs on the ground.
Well, again, you can see nothing, you see, when you're taxiing. It's in a three-point landing position, i.e. at a fairly steep angle, isn't it? And you're back there. You can see the ground either side of you here, just because you're on the trailing edge of the wing. But you can see nothing in front of you. And so taxiing, you had to taxi backwards and forwards, sideways, the whole time, never... go a few seconds and then turn and turn and turn and turn to make sure there's nobody in front of you, or the fellow in front of you hasn't stopped or something, and you go bawling on, you'll hit him because you can't see him.
Was that a problem on a carrier?
No, you never did any taxiing on a carrier. You landed on, caught the hook, caught, pull the aircraft to a halt, and then no time at all, a few feet. You then with the engine was throttled back, the plane would automatically tend to go back a few feet, having been pulled up by the reservoir. It would then drift back a few feet, just enough for the deck handling party to unhook the hook from the wire. You get then had another fellow in front, like you do at an airfield now, you know, Heathrow or whatever. The fellow will beckon you forward to tell you where to go. You taxi very slowly, very short distance, folding the wings as you went, and then he'd say stick it over there or whatever, and then shut it off, and that's all the taxiing you ever did on the carrier. And you didn't use the brakes either, practically, just to stop it. So when you took the aircraft ashore at Maryborough, then that's north of Brisbane, onto an airfield, and the Victorious came back to Sydney. They didn't want the aircraft on the ship. They wanted a ship free of airplane. We landed on this airfield and started to taxi, and of course none of the brakes worked because they hadn't been used for 3 or 4 months. And they were disc brakes, of course, and they're probably all rusty, like unused car disc brakes. And you put touch the brakes and the thing would stop dead or not stop at all. So we were warned of this, but when we were, you know, we were taking off to go to a land, to a shore station, watch the brakes, because they're not going to be very good. they soon recovered, you know, because you rub off the rust, don't you? So that was...
What about taking off from a carrier? Because obviously visibility would that be a problem again?
Taking off? Well... The only trouble with taking off in a carrier is that you've got 36 aircraft. You probably want to take off 30 of them. And you range them on the flight deck from the back. So the back three, and then the next lot, and then the next lot. And by the time the leading chap at the front, half the deck is lost to him. So he's only got a relatively short run to take off, and the latter people, number 3, 4, 6, 8, whatever, they'd all got a bit more deck to go on. But if you were in the first three, really you know you had to know what you were doing and hope there was enough wind speed over the deck.